Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Hi, I'm Libby, and I'll be reading you today's Cape Cod Times, dated Friday, March 8th, 2024. For our weather forecast, we will see the sun a little bit today. This afternoon, the sun will peek out from all those clouds, and it will reach into the low 40s. Tonight, lows dip down back into the 30s, and over the weekend, the outlook is cloudy and rainy, with highs on Saturday in the low 40s, and on Sunday, reaching into the low 50s. By special request from a few of our faithful listeners, we now present the lottery numbers. For Thursday's numbers game, the midday drawing numbers were 7, 2, 6, and 5. For the evening drawing, we have numbers 5, 7, 6, and 7. Thursday's mass cash drawing numbers were 7, 11, 13, 15, and 21. The Powerball drawing on Wednesday had numbers 6, 19, 28, 44, 60, and the extra ball of number 10. And finally, for the Mega Millions drawing last Tuesday, we have numbers 2, 49, 50, 61, 70, and an extra ball of 14. The lead story on today's paper is headlined, Dredge Beachwork Begin on Kootuat Bay, by Heather McCarron of the Cape Cod Times. Dateline, Kootuat. As a light rain fell and waves splashed against the town dock on Thursday morning, a crew from the Barnstable County Dredge Program loaded a length of pipe onto a boat bound for the nearby entrance channel to Kootuat Bay. The work was part of preparations for the Kootuat Bay dredging project, which officially began on Monday. This week's activities involved shuttling pipes and materials to the channel, according to Barnstable Department of Public Works Communication Manager Kelly Colopy. The $714,200 project is being undertaken by the County Dredge, along with contractor Diggett Construction of South Dennis. Dredging is expected to begin in earnest next week, and depending on the weather, will take place Monday through Saturday from 7 to 5. Work may also be done on Sunday. Town engineer Griffin Bowden said the project has two parts, dredging the channel and shoring up the beach at the eastern end of Dead Neck Samson's Island, a barrier beach system that spans about 15 acres between Kootuat and West Bays on Nantucket Sound. Work on both will be done at the same time. The county dredge will dredge the material, and it will be pumped through a pipeline to the east end of Dead Neck, where the town's contractor will place the nourishment material on the island, Bowden said. What is dredging? Dredging is the removal of sand, silt, and other debris from the bottom of water bodies. As sand and silt washes downstream, sedimentation gradually fills channels and harbors, Barnstable Water Resources says on its website. Dredging is needed so water bodies can remain navigable and to maintain the health of the ecosystem so that it does not fall victim to eutrophication, where excess nutrients accelerate the growth of algae and cyanobacteria. The demand for dredging on Cape Cod has increased in recent years due to climate change implications, annual sand dynamics brought about by seasonal storms, as well as the availability of additional state grant funding for projects. There has also been interest in the dredging of freshwater ponds, the county dredge notes on its website. Why does Kootuat Bay Channel need to be dredged? Bowden said channels require regular dredging in order to maintain safe navigation due to natural processes that result in sediment being deposited. The town's comprehensive dredge plan recommends dredging the entrance channel about every 10 to 15 years, based on how often the channel had been dredged before, he said. The last documented dredging of the channel was 1998. Work at Dead Neck, Bowden said, is to stem severe erosion from numerous southerly coastal storms in the last few years. The dune at the east end of the island, directly adjacent to the West Bay breakwater, has completely eroded, and the island is breached during high storm surge events, Bowden said. The dredged materials will be placed in this area to reestablish the dune and fill in the breach. The area is an important migration stop and breeding area for shorebirds, including near-threatened piping plovers, according to the Massachusetts Audubon Society. The organization maintains the Sampson's Island Wildlife Sanctuary on part of the island. What's planned for the channel dredge and how long will it take? Colopy said the channel work calls for a 100-foot-wide dredge. The goal of this project is to dredge the southern approach to the channel closest to Sampson's Island. This area is currently shallower than the permitted channel depths and thus is being targeted for dredging, she said. The dredge will start at the southernmost extent and work its way north. Due to seasonal restrictions, the town must conclude work by April 1st and expects to finish half the project this season, Colopy said. The town wants to complete the entire project this year if weather cooperates, she said. Helping to pay for the project is a $300,000 grant from the State Executive Office of Economic Development, supplemented by a town capital fund. Advisory for mariners. The town advises mariners to be mindful of the work and use caution while navigating the waters around the dredging operation. For any questions or to receive project updates, contact Kelly Colopy at the Department of Public Works. Man pleads not guilty to assault and gun charges by Zane Razek of the Cape Cod Times. Dateline Barnstable. A 30-year-old Hyannis man accused of holding his mother at knife point on Wednesday and keeping Barnstable police at bay for about 7 hours entered not guilty pleas in court. Justin Morea was held without bail after a Thursday arraignment at Barnstable District Court. This is a very serious case, his attorney Nat Carney told media outside the courthouse. The first thing I'm going to do is speak with my client. I'll be guided by what he tells me. Morera is charged with kidnapping, 9 counts of firearm armed assault to murder, intimidation of a witness, 3 counts of carrying without a license, and 9 counts of assault with a dangerous weapon, a firearm. He is also charged with assault with a dangerous weapon, a knife, firearm use in felony, firearm armed assault to murder, carrying a loaded firearm without a license, and ammunition without FID card possession. When did the standoff in Hyannis start? Around 7:41 a.m. on Wednesday, Barnstable police officers were called to 24 St. Francis Circle, after receiving a report that Morera was holding his mother at knife point, according to police. The caller told the dispatcher he, his mother, and another female had barricaded themselves in a basement bedroom, and Morera, who was likely armed, was somewhere inside the house, according to police. Officers were able to evacuate the 3 people out of the home through a window. Morera's mother told a police lieutenant that her son was scheduled to attend a court date at Barnstable Superior Court that morning. The court appointment was related to an indictment stemming from charges that he had allegedly threatened to shoot up a school in May 2022. She was in the living room when he allegedly approached her with a knife demanding the keys to her gun safe. Morera's mother has an active license to carry permit, according to prosecutors. He stated to her that, "The feds are going to get me, I'm going to get killed," at which point he grabbed her phone, reads a police report, which also alleges Morera threatened to stab his mother. The Cape Cod Regional SWAT team was called to the scene and took over command of the police response. As police and the SWAT team established a perimeter around the house, Morera allegedly opened the front door and was seen holding a firearm. He retreated into the house, at which point several rounds were fired by Morera from inside of the residence toward perimeter officers. Police later found that Morera had struck the armored SWAT vehicle that was in front of the house with at least 7 rounds, while 1 additional round was found lodged in the front yard tree. Over the course of the standoff, Morera allegedly made statements such as, "I've shot 8 rounds at it. There must be no one in the SWAT truck. I've been shooting at it. I want them dead." He also allegedly stated, 30 minutes to get me a car, or I'm going to start taking people out. When he was advised he was going to Cape Cod Hospital, he allegedly responded, "No, I've already fired shots." At one point, Massachusetts State Police sent a robotic dog inside the home to try to find and convince the man to come out of the home. But he allegedly shot the robot and partially disabled it. Later in the standoff, the SWAT team deployed a form of pepper spray into the house, but the man remained inside. Finally, a specialty ballistic vehicle with an attached demolition tool arrived on the scene and was used to forcibly encourage the man to exit the residence, according to police. Records show Moreira does not possess a license to carry, according to authorities, and is not eligible for a license to carry because of his criminal convictions in Massachusetts. Moreira also has 41 entries on his adult board of probation record, including charges of carrying a dangerous weapon. He was on federal probation for being a felon in possession of a firearm and silencer, and being a felon in possession of ammunition. So essentially, you have an individual who has made a number of threats to hurting the police, hurting individuals with firearms, and that's exactly what he tried to do yesterday, said Second Assistant District Attorney Tara Coppola. Negotiations with Moreira continued until he was placed into custody at 4:03 p.m. on Wednesday. When police later searched the crime scene, they found 37 shell casings from three different firearms. Monomoy Refuge Visitor Center to be demolished, by Eric Williams of the Cape Cod Times. Erosion is always nibbling on Cape Cod, but it's been munching away with abandon at the Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge in Chatham. A series of breaks in a protective barrier beach over the years, combined with powerful currents, has left the refuge's base of operations open to the destructive force of the Atlantic Ocean. Richard Nye, refuge manager, estimated that some areas near the public parking lot have lost about 30 feet per year to erosion over the past 3 years. The stairs that once took visitors down to the beach are gone. And in recent years, a National Weather Service station, a refuge dormitory, and a bathroom facility have been removed. Now it's last call for the refuge's visitor center. The building, which has been in place for approximately 50 years, is expected to be demolished in April. An open house at the center on 30 Wickies Way in Chatham will be held from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on March 9th. It's a final chance for folks to tour the building, check out displays, talk to staff and volunteers, and share memories. Nye said the visitor center is currently about 90 feet from the edge of a quickly crumbling bluff. But the center's septic tank is about 30 feet closer to the edge. Heavy equipment will be needed for the removal of the tank and visitor center, so advanced planning was required to make an orderly retreat. "We don't have a lot of time left, and we can't risk waiting," said Nye. "We want to stay ahead of the rate of erosion." The visitor center also houses staff offices. Nye said he's looking for a replacement facility in the Chatham area to provide offices and a place for visitors to get information about the refuge. And information kiosk will remain in place near the current visitor center. Changes are also planned for the refuge's parking lot. Nye said the pavement will be removed and replaced with crushed rock or other porous material. "The parking lot is going to shrink," said Nye, adding that visitors will still be able to park along the causeway that connects the refuge's base of operations to the rest of Chatham. Access to the refuge's popular Morris Island Trail system will still be available. In recent years, erosion has forced the trail to be rerouted out to the beach via a right-of-way. Moving to the sports pages, we have an article headlined, "Girls Basketball Playoffs, Defense Carries Bourne to Its First Elite Eight," by Courtney Jacobs of the Cape Cod Times. On February 25th, Paige Mehta of the Bourne girls basketball team was named the South Coast Conference Most Valuable Player, or MVP. Being an MVP is not just about how many points a player averages each game, which is why the word valuable is in the title. The award is given to players who can affect the game in more ways than one. Paige is not just a scorer, born head coach Stephen Wenzel said. She's another coach on the court. She distributes the basketball. She's keyed on by other teams, and she's unselfish. All of those aspects of Mehta's game helped Bourne to a 44-36 win over Northbridge in the MIAA Division IV Sweet 16 on Wednesday. After she scored 7 points in the opening quarter, Mehta was held to 2 points over the next three quarters and finished with 9 points. Well, good thing basketball is a team sport. The Blake Show. When your star player is having an off game in the playoffs, somebody else gets the chance to step up. Say hello to Reagan Blake. The 2-year varsity starting sophomore is not shy of the big moment. Wenzel said that he asks Blake to do a lot of different things. He noted that she has played every single minute of every single game this season. She can handle the basketball. She can shoot threes, and we ask her to play in the paint because she's so strong, Wenzel said. She's fearless when she gets the ball in her hands. Whenever her team needed her, whether it was a basket, rebound, pass, or steal, Blake responded. She finished with a game high of 19 points. I'm very proud of myself, but I really couldn't do it without my team, Blake said. You can't do the points, passes, rebounds, everything without your team. I'm thankful for them. The Lockdown. The Lady Canalmen trailed 30-27 at halftime, which was largely in part to Northbridge's 5'11" junior, Molly Gahan. Gahan had 14 points in the first half and scored at will with her size advantage. Bourne had prepared all week to defend her. We knew coming in that number 4, Gahan, was going to be a beast, and she was, Wenzel said. Everything goes through her, and being a little bit of an undersized team, we had to play a style of defense that we haven't played all year long. That defense involved surrounding Gahan in the paint every time she touched the ball, whether it was 2, 3, or even 4 players. This led to only 2 points for Gahan and 6 total team points in the second half. Once she started falling apart, the whole team kind of fell apart, Blake said. Starting guard Aubrey France was in foul trouble for the first 3 quarters, but Wenzel said having her in the end was a big part of that second half lockdown. Up top, she just adjusts so well to the ball in the air, Wenzel said. She understands how to guard all 4 positions, even though she's a guard. Bringing her in the fourth quarter with 4 fouls helped shut them down. Next up, the Lady Canalmen are 20-2 on the season and have won 10 of their last 11 games. Their 2 losses were by a total of 12 points. Bourne's first trip to the Elite 8 in program history will be the toughest test of the season. The second-seeded Tingsboro is next up on the schedule. They are 21-1, with the only flaw being a 4-point loss at the hands of Division IV top seed Cathedral. Since then, they have won 15 straight games. If this were a regular season game, it may be different, but this is winner-go-home playoff basketball. The good news for Bourne is that they are unbeaten on the road at 9-0, so traveling 96 miles away is not a big concern. We have nothing to lose. We're the underdogs. It's either leave it all there and win or lose, Mehta said. First over-the-counter glucose monitor cleared by Eduardo Cuevas of USA Today. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has cleared the first over-the-counter monitor that continuously checks glucose levels. The Stelo Glucose Biosensor System, a wearable sensor that pairs with a smartphone to track blood sugar levels, is meant for people 18 and older who don't use insulin and are treating diabetes with oral medications, and adults who don't have diabetes but want to track glucose levels, the agency said in a news release Tuesday. The product is made by the company Dexcom. Today's clearance expands access to these devices, Dr. Jeff Shuren, director of the FDA's Center for Devices and Radiological Health, said in a statement. It allows people to assess their blood sugar without the involvement of a healthcare provider, advancing health equity for patients by providing valuable information regardless of access to a doctor or insurance. About 25 million people in the U.S. with type 2 diabetes don't use insulin, but can benefit from continuous glucose monitoring, according to a Dexcom news release. The company, based in San Diego, already has another monitor on the market, the Dexcom G7, for people with a prescription. The new Stelo device pairs a sensor worn on the back of the upper arm with a smartphone app to monitor, record, and analyze glucose values. It takes these measurements every 15 minutes. The sensor can be used up to 15 days before the user needs to replace it. The FDA noted that the monitor isn't designed for people with concerns about low blood sugar, since it doesn't alert people when levels are low or drop. The FDA based its decision this week on an outside clinical study that showed the device performed similarly to other integrated continuous glucose monitors, officials said. Dexcom plans to make Stelo available this summer. A company spokesperson declined to provide pricing estimates, but said the device would be competitive. Sky-high stakes for State of the Union, by Joey Garrison of USA Today. Dateline, Washington. President Joe Biden gave a pivotal State of the Union address Thursday, as he looked to silence skeptics about his ability to keep serving, convince restless Americans the economy is strong, and reestablish the stakes of a likely rematch against Donald Trump. The results of Super Tuesday and subsequent withdrawal of Nikki Haley from the Republican primary makes this week the unofficial start of the general election. In what could be his final State of the Union address, the moment could not have been much bigger for Biden, who is saddled with challenges at home and abroad. Biden hears heckling regularly from pro-Palestinian protesters as he tries to navigate the U.S. role in the Israel-Hamas war without further alienating his liberal base. He's not yet been able to assuage concerns about his age. Despite a booming stock market and historically low unemployment, Biden isn't getting credit for an economic rebound. His approval rating, already hovering in the low 40s for 2 years, dipped even lower in recent weeks. And triggering anxiety among Democrats, Biden's fundamental re-election message that the battle for the soul of America isn't over hasn't clicked yet for the majority of voters. Trump leads Biden in most polls nationally and in battleground states that will decide the election. But the State of the Union is a presidential showcase. This year, it gave Biden the opportunity to set the stage for November and flesh out contrasts with Trump that haven't yet crystallized among voters. What he needs to try to do is begin to shape a narrative about the upcoming election. Because right now, he's on his heels, William Howell, a political scientist at the University of Chicago, said before the speech. I think it's a huge moment, said Barbara Perry, director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. This is sort of the kickoff of the real campaign. Biden needed, she added, to hit it out of the park. To win in November, Biden must unite a fraying Democratic coalition, with polling showing softening support from core constituencies such as Black, Latino, and young voters. He needs to enthuse those in his party who are clearly unenthusiastic about him to some degree and are concerned about his age, Perry said. A poll released March 2nd by the New York Times Siena College had Trump ahead of Biden, 48% to 43% among registered voters. It underscored Biden's base struggles, finding that 97% of Americans who voted for Trump in 2020 said they'll vote for him again in 2024. But only 83% of Biden voters from 2020 said they will vote for Biden this fall. The Biden campaign has long maintained that the president's struggling poll numbers don't accurately reflect where things will stand in November when voters have a clear choice and consider the consequences of a second Trump presidency. In a memo the day after Super Tuesday, the campaign downplayed national polling against Trump, saying it confirms what we know to be true. This will be a very close general election contest. The memo said upwards of 10% of voters remain undecided, a share of the electorate much larger than the current margin between Trump and Biden in polling. They said these voters overwhelmingly support Biden's policies, and the Biden campaign plans to aggressively engage them. Biden spent a long weekend at the Camp David presidential retreat working on the State of the Union address with top aides. Leaving for the speech-writing sessions, he carried a book that seemed to reflect the tests he faces. Possible: How We Survive and Thrive in an Age of Conflict. In recent weeks, Biden has queued up his re-election themes. He emphasizes the need to protect American democracy and restore reproductive rights. He blames Trump's three Supreme Court nominees for overturning Roe v. Wade's constitutional right to an abortion. He has come out more vocally on migrants. Last week, during a visit to the U.S.-Mexico border in Texas, Biden challenged Trump to join me in pushing for the bipartisan border legislation bill, which includes some of the strongest enforcement measures in a generation. Congressional Republicans killed the bill at the urging of Trump. On a positive side, Biden touts historic job growth and frames his record in bold terms. The White House has started saying he's accomplishing more in 3 years than most presidents have in 2 years. Biden says America needs to re-elect him to protect his agenda on infrastructure, lowering prescription drug prices, and domestic manufacturing. He has tried to position himself on the side of the working class by emphasizing efforts to take on so-called junk fees, lower health care premiums, and making corporations pay their fair share of taxes. But for all the policy talk, Biden's first order of business this election season remains convincing a public wary of his age that he's up for the job for another 4 years. Concerns about the 81-year-old Biden's status hiked up last month after a report from Justice Department Special Counsel Robert Hur portrayed the president as a well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. For the State of the Union, Biden plans to hit the road, speaking in Philadelphia today and Atlanta on Saturday, two battleground states, Pennsylvania and Georgia, that could decide the election. He's also dispatching cabinet members and other top officials across the country to amplify the message. If he can shape the terms of the debate, if he can shape this public sense about what's at stake in this upcoming election, he'll be able to recover some advantage that right now is slipping, Howell said. We've reached the halfway point of today's broadcast, and regular listeners are aware that at this point we move to the obituaries. The first obituary is for William Francis O'Brien. Dateline, Eastham. William Francis O'Brien, August 9, 1948 to March 2, 2024. The world is in desperate need of what Dr. William Francis O'Brien personified. He modeled empathy, grace, moral clarity, and the Jesuit ideal of service to others. Born and raised in Westfield, Bill graduated Lemoyne College in 1970 and earned a Ph.D. in psychology from The Ohio State University in 1975. He retired as Chief of Psychiatry and Mental Health at the Veterans Administration in Dayton, Ohio, after posts in Battle Creek, Michigan, and Newport News, Virginia. Bill specialized in veterans experiencing PTSD and substance abuse disorders, as well as former prisoners of war. He had a healthy disrespect for authority, shunning, for instance, the congressman who only showed for veterans' parades but did not do the legislative work of veterans' advocacy. While deeply serious about his work, Bill did not bring it home. He prioritized his wife, Julie Crimmings O'Brien, whom he met in college and married soon after, and their daughter, Dr. Erin O'Brien. Julie and Bill were a formidable duo, and he loved with deep support, especially as Julie faced the breast cancer that took her life in 2002. He named his pride in Aaron to Aaron, ended every conversation with, "Love ya, bud," and made sure Aaron always texted when she got home. Bill O'Brien knew tragedy, having lost his beloved mother, Mary Lynch O'Brien, in college. His father, George E. O'Brien, before Bill turned 50, and his wife, Julie, in their early 50s. He held them for the whole of his life and found determination to live life fully after loss. Bill retired from the VA in 2009 and moved to Cape Cod. There, he was rewarded with a second love, Jane O'Brien. They married in 2019 and reveled in their luck of finding each other and living on Cape. Bill gathered her son David Reinhardt into his life and heart. Beach dinners with sandwiches, cookies, wine, and Bill's beloved Coke was their favorite tradition. William was a loving brother to his sister Joanne, brother-in-law, uncle, and second dad. In selecting friends, he valued character over titles. He checked in when times were good or bad, and he had authentic style, unafraid of color and a watch for each ensemble. Bill O'Brien was a lifelong athlete, pitcher at Lemoyne College, marathoner, Cape Rail Trail cyclist, and took up golf in his 40s. He almost always made the putt or got the out, and on the rare times he missed, congratulated the opponent. His love languages included college football, Notre Dame and Ohio State in that order, Red Sox baseball, and family sports text chains. He took his Catholic faith seriously and found true solace in it. He lived the core values of Catholicism in every aspect of his life, favoring faith and acceptance over dogma. He was an active member of Catholic parishes in every city in which he lived. In lieu of flowers, contributions can be made in memory of Bill O'Brien to the Julia Crimmings O'Brien 71 Memorial Scholarship Fund at Lemoyne College, or a charity to be named later that supplements costs for low-income children in sports. A viewing will be held on March 10th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Nickerson Funeral Home in Orleans. A funeral mass will be said on March 11th at St. Joan of Arc Catholic Church in Orleans at 11 a.m. Burial will be held March 13th at 1 p.m. in Westfield at St. Mary's Cemetery. For online condolences, please visit the website of Nickerson Funerals. Louis R. Calabrese, Dateline, West Yarmouth. Louis A. Calabrese, age 89, of West Yarmouth, was born on February 17, 1935, to the late Vincenzo and Ida Balsamo Calabrese in Milford. He passed away at Cape Cod Hospital with his loving family by his side on March 4th. He was brother of the late Joanne. He was a Korean War Marine Corps veteran, and we thank him for that service. Louis was married to the late Johann Calabrese Smout. He was a loving and devoted father to the late Donna, Louis, Vincent, and John. He's survived by Tiffany Davis and her husband, 6 great-grandchildren, 4 nieces, and many other family members. In 1990, Louis retired from General Motors and moved down to the Cape with his wife. Over the next several years, Louis added on and remodeled his cottage in West Yarmouth. Louis was a dedicated member of both Sacred Heart Church in Milford and St. Pius X Church in South Yarmouth. A calling hour will be held Saturday, March 9th, from 8:30 to 9:30 a.m. at the Consigli Ruggiero Funeral Home on Water Street in Milford. A mass of Christian burial will follow at 10 a.m. at the Sacred Heart of Jesus Church on East Main Street. The burial will follow in the parish cemetery. Lorna M. Erskine Casella, Dateline, Danvers. Of Peabody, formerly of Saugus, March 3rd. Wife of the late Philip Casella. Loving mother of Philip R. Casella and his wife Paula of Saugus. Valerie and her husband Mark Salesman of Wenham, and Gary Casella of Saugus. mother-in-law of Kim Casella of Danvers, cherished grandmother of many, sister of the late L sisters, Lily Louise, Laura, Leola, and Linda. Relatives and friends are invited to attend a remembrance service in the Brooksby Village Chapel on Village Drive in Peabody on Tuesday at 4:30 p.m. Interment the churchyard in Woods Hole on Wednesday at noon. For the obituary and condolences, please go to the website Bisbee Porcella. Felicia Fatini, Dateline Centerville. Felicia Fatini passed on Wednesday, March 6th in Plymouth. Felicia was born Felicita Domenica Bertone on April 3, 1932, in her beloved Turin, Italy. She was the only child to Angela and Antonio Bertone. Her father passed away at a young age, and she was forced to grow up early to survive the chaos and scarcity of World War II. After the war, she met her husband, Federico Fatini, who had moved to Turin to find work. They got married in 1953 and had their only son, Walter, in 1956. In 1967, she left her life in Turin behind to move to the United States to relocate closer to her husband's family. She lived in Newton for 25 years and worked at St. Regis Paper Factory. After retiring, Felicia moved to Cape Cod to be closer to his son, her son, and his family. Her retirement years were spent enjoying the peace and quiet of their Centerville home, cooking delicious meals for her family, and spending several winters with her husband in their vacation home in Florida. Her husband, Federico, passed away in 2022. They were married for 69 years. Felicia was survived by son Walter, daughter-in-law Leah, and her grandson Brian. Visiting hours are on Monday, March 11th from 9 to 11 at Doan, Beal, and Ames on West Main Street in Hyannis. Burial will immediately follow at St. Francis Xavier Cemetery in Centerville, where Felicia will be laid to rest beside her beloved husband. Rosemary LaRue, Dateline, South Yarmouth. It is with heavy hearts that we announce the passing of Rosemary E. LaRue from a prolonged, courageous battle with cancer. Rosemary passed away on February 29th with her daughter by her side and endless loving prayers and thoughts from her devoted family and friends. She is the beloved daughter of John Patrick Dunn of Collinsville, Connecticut, and Winifred McMahon of Unionville, Connecticut. She is predeceased by her oldest sister, Winnie, and survived by her middle sister, Donna. She leaves behind two children, Trish and Jason, and her grandson, Rocco. A graduate of Bristol Eastern, she worked, traveled, raised a family, and then re-entered the workforce to create and run a department at the Hartford Insurance Company for many years. If she wasn't decorating, renovating, or gardening, she was making cookies for her mechanics, neighbors, or anyone else she saw with kindness. She loved to entertain and have fun year-round. Her love of five speeds and fast cars is a testament to her bravery and fearlessness, and a window into just how fun she was and always will be. She was happiest on the beach and laughing with friends. Rosemary's funeral mass will be held at Sacred Heart Chapel on Summer Street in Yarmouthport on Saturday, March 9th at 11 a.m. Interment will follow in Chandler Gray Cemetery. John James Friel, Dateline Barnstable. John James J.J. Friel of West Barnstable, proud father of Jackson, devoted husband to his beloved Beth, loving son, best big brother, and greatest uncle, cousin, nephew, son-in-law, and friend of all time, left this world unexpectedly on February 24th at the age of 44. He was surrounded by the love of his family. J.J. is the first of three sons born to Kevin and Carol Ann Hurley Friel on February 14th, 1980. J.J.'s infectious smile and gigantic heart were evident from the start. His childhood was spent learning the things that he would love for his entire life: fishing, hockey, boats, bikes, planes, family, and lawnmowers. JJ graduated from Barnstable High School in 1998 and went on to earn his degree in horticulture, production, and landscape management at SUNY Morrisville before attending UMass Amherst. JJ earned and held many certifications and licensures. His favorite, of course, was his hoisting license. JJ loved running a machine. After college, JJ enjoyed careers at Sconset Gardner, EJ Jaxtimer Builder, Inc., and most recently, Crawford Land Management. JJ's true passion was hockey. He loved his hockey community from Barnstable to the Morrisville Mustangs to Nantucket Hockey. If he was ever your teammate, coach, or player, he loved you. JJ was larger than life in stature and personality. He was always encouraging of those around him and was able to see the best in everyone. If you needed him for anything, he was there and could make any tough task into a happy day. He always finished the job. JJ was a valued member of his community. As a member of the West Barnstable Civic Association, he volunteered at the spaghetti suppers, led his annual Earth Day cleanup team, and was the friendly parking attendant and traffic director at the West Barnstable Village Festival for several years. JJ is survived by his wife, Beth Meager Friel, his son Jackson, his mother Carol, his brother Kevin, and many other family members. He is predeceased by his father, Kevin Sr. He leaves behind a very close and large extended family, all of whom he loved beyond measure. Visiting hours will be at Chapman Funeral Home in Marston's Mills on March 16th from 4 to 7 p.m. Funeral services will be held at the First Baptist Church in Hyannis on March 17th at 1 p.m. JJ's burial will be private. In lieu of flowers, a fund has been established to benefit JJ's son Jackson. Donations can be made in person at any Cooperative Bank of Cape Cod branch. Donations can be made by mail to the Cooperative Bank of Cape Cod, attention Julie Fox, at their Falmouth address. Today's Ask Carolyn column is headlined, "Wedding Guests Melt Down Over Rules for Which Kids Get Invited." Hi, Carolyn. My youngest cousin got engaged. My daughters and nieces, ages 14 to 26, were excited for another family wedding until we learned from his mother no older children are invited, not even teenagers. This means pretty much every kid on my cousin's side is excluded, while the bride's family has all younger children. She's afraid they won't make the trip if their kids aren't invited, so it's the reverse of the no children wedding where young children aren't invited. I've never heard of this. I told my mother that while I understand the bride wanting her family at the wedding, the point they are missing is that family is on both sides, and also that these older children would not only know they weren't invited to the wedding, but also will remember, while the younger children won't even know or care. My aunt is distraught over this whole thing. They are paying for half the wedding, but now most of our side of the family won't be able to attend, or is choosing not to because their kids are being purposefully snubbed. I don't even want to attend, and neither does my brother, but we'll probably go without our spouses, mainly for my aunt's sake. Have you ever heard of this, and what is your advice on how to handle it? Should we say something to our cousin? Signed, C. Dear C, I thought I had heard every inclusion or exclusion tactic for a wedding guest list, but this is a new one for me. I'm not as unsympathetic to their decision as you are, though. I don't agree with their logic, because they're excluding family who are excited to be there in favor of family who'd be fine with a nap and a sitter. But having to limit guest lists is simple reality for most couples. They're focusing on the adults of your generation and above from both sides of the family. That's a fair target, like it or not. Plus, setting limits is their prerogative, and I respect that. I urge you to respect it too, but not by showing up grudgingly and stag just to make your aunt happy. Call it a grow up and show up. Accept that weddings are stressful and expensive. Except that couples face impossible choices. Except that some of the choices they make under pressure may not be the greatest. Except that some sub-great choices don't make them bad people worth alienating with a huffy reciprocal snub. Think about it for a second. You've taken offense on the grounds that family is paramount. But counter-snubbing your cousin and his bride is not exactly the way to claim the high ground on family warm fuzzies. So my advice for handling this is for you to attend graciously and with your plus one, and urge your kids to release any hard feelings, and make one calm and kind attempt to talk boycotters from your side of the family off the ledge. Advocate for the couple as follows. Remind them that event planning is stressful and couples aren't perfect. For all you know, the bride did this in the first place to appease boycotters on her side. Remind the boycotters they have choices too. They can get offended and blow it all up, or they can assume the exclusions aren't personal and have some grace and show up. Keep family unity alive to fight another day, or something like that. The Best Bets column in today's newspaper is headlined Pet Parade, Impromptu Songs, A Feast of Food at Provincetown Festival by Frankie Rowley of the Cape Cod Times. It's time to leave the house and celebrate as the Provincetown and Outer Cape Year-Rounders Festival returns for its 37th year on March 9th. As always, artists, artisans, town committees, and nonprofits will fill tables inside Town Hall. The pet parade and silent auction will commence in the afternoon, and a feast, performances, and a few surprises will fill the evening. We had a chicken win one time, and somebody's pot-belly pig and a baby goat, said Elise Cozy, one of the festival's organizers. We don't discriminate. The shellfish warden is coming. I told him to bring his pet clam. As for the surprises, Cozy said they're as much of a shock to her and her team as they are to the attendees. They never know what's going to happen or who'll jump on stage until they do. We never know who's going to come in with a guitar or a boombox or a piano or whatever, she said. Beyond the surprises, the fun of the festival lies in the sense of community present throughout the event. We get to see people we haven't seen all winter because everybody's doing their thing, Cozy said. The Provincetown and Outer Cape Year-Rounders Festival begins at 10 a.m. this morning at Provincetown Town Hall on Commercial Street and is free to attend. For more information, go to the festival's Facebook page. What to do this week on Cape Cod? Reception for Lost History Rediscovered. The Cultural Center of Cape Cod is holding a reception for its latest exhibition, Lost History Rediscovered, a deep dive into the history of the Yarmouth and Bass River area, co-curated by Bob Kelly, president of the Old Yarmouth Historical Society. On March 9th, today, the exhibition will feature a one-day-only oral history presentation and discussion with Nupik Wampanoag tribal member Wabin Webquish. The Friends of Bass River will provide a present-day perspective of Bass River's current state, touching on its elevated nitrogen levels and how we can help conserve the river's ecosystem. Kelly will also deliver a series of lectures for the exhibition at 2 p.m. on March 30th. The reception is free to attend. The exhibition will run until March 30th. For more information, visit the Cultural Center of Cape Cod's website. Cape Cod Music Society celebrates the beginning of spring with two Cape Cod String Quartet concerts in Wellfleet and Falmouth. After a sold-out show on March 3rd, the Cape Cod String Quartet returns with a new date for their Spring is Here 2024 show, presented by the Cape Cod Music Society at 7 p.m. on March 15th at the Wellfleet Preservation Hall and at the College Light Opera Company in Falmouth. The series focuses on Max Richter's Spring One Recomposed, Richter's interpretation of Vivaldi's The Four Seasons, according to a press release for the event. The program also features Mozart's Dissonance Quartet and George Walker's Lyric for Strings. Tickets for the March 15th show at the College Light Opera Company on Chappaquoit Road in West Falmouth are $35 and can be purchased online at the College Light Opera Company's website. Historic Book Party at the Nye Museum in East Sandwich. Celebrate books with the Nye Museum during their History Book Party, 6:30 p.m. on March 12th at the Nye Museum's Grange Hall. Inspired by Nye historian John Cullity's research on the Cedarville Reading Circle, Nye Museum Executive Director Amy Johnson wanted to host a party in honor of history books, both fiction and nonfiction, and give local history lovers a chance to share their favorite titles, authors, and stories with other history buffs. The party is free to attend, and guests are asked to register with the museum online at nyemuseum.org or by calling the museum. Light refreshments will be served at the event. The Cape Cod Women's Association meeting. In honor of Women's History Month, the Cape Cod Women's Association is hosting a meeting at 5:30 p.m. at the Family Table Collaborative on March 12th. During the meeting, a dinner will be hosted for attendees. Members of the Cape Cod Women's Association will deliver speeches about their experiences being a woman on the Cape, and a raffle will be thrown in support of the organization. Attendees are asked to bring an item, such as a book, bottle of wine, or box of chocolates for the raffle. Tickets for the meeting are $35 for members and $45 for non-members and can be purchased online at the organization's website. The Family Table Collaborative is located on Route 28 in South Yarmouth. These Cape Cod restaurants mark St. Patrick's Day with Irish food, by Gwen Friss of the Cape Cod Times. With Sunday being the traditional day for brunch and St. Patrick's Day falling on a Sunday this year, it's not surprising that Cape Cod's newest holiday celebration is a brunch. But you might be surprised to hear that the meal is on wheels. The first St. Patrick's Day brunch train leaves Hyannis at 11:30 a.m. on Sunday, March 17th, in what Cape Cod Central Railroad plans to make an annual trip. Don't forget to wear your best dress in green in case the leprechauns are close by, according to the railroad's website. We wouldn't want to see you get pinched. Brunch includes an appetizer, entree, and dessert served while the train travels 2.5 hours from Hyannis to the Cape Cod Canal and back. Prices are $65 to $95 depending on seating location, and $50 to $70 for ages 3 to 12 with a children's menu. Holiday entrees include Irish Benedict, traditional shepherd's pie, Irish cod fish cakes, as well as corned beef and cabbage with a full cash bar available. Guests are asked to arrive 45 minutes before departure, with boarding starting 30 minutes before the prompt 11:30 a.m. departure. For more information, visit the website capetrain.com. Here are four more places to get an Irish meal on Cape Cod. Wherever you decide to go, be sure to call about the availability of corned beef and cabbage. Purists will tell you it is an Irish-American tradition started in New York City, not Ireland, by immigrants. Liam McGuire's, nearly a century on the same spot in Falmouth. Liam McGuire's Irish pub and restaurant on Main Street in Falmouth offers a side of history with each Irish specialty served. The spot started out nearly a century ago as Bowman's Bakery and Confection, and then in 1948 became Townhouse Restaurant for nearly five decades. In 1994, Liam and Deborah McGuire established the pub where Liam, who hailed from Castle Derg in County Tyrone, held court nightly with his stories of traveling Europe. The restaurant's namesake died in 2021, but regulars still come by to eat and raise a glass. Liam McGuire's has Irish dishes, including steak and Guinness stew, year-round, but is also adding corned beef and cabbage on St. Patrick's Day, and a full day of live entertainment from Irish step dancing to pipes. At Liam McGuire's Irish pub and restaurant, we've strived not only to serve up fantastic grub and the best live entertainment for the fine folks of Falmouth, but also to recreate the cozy ambience of the pubs back home in Ireland, according to the website. Fiddles, twinkling lights, feel like home at O'Shea's Old Inn in West Dennis. A New England pub in the Irish tradition on Main Street in West Dennis looks like someone's house, and the hospitality inside will make you feel like you are in the embrace of friends. You may sit shoulder to shoulder with the Irish musicians under a canopy of twinkling white lights, with a half circle of children dancing nearby. O'Shea's offers Irish food year-round, including Irish lamb stew, corned beef Reuben, shepherd's pie, and the homey bangers and mash. O'Shea's is closed on Wednesdays, but the restaurant's calendar shows live music every other day in March, including four acts beginning with Sean Brennan scheduled for March 17th. The Old Triangle is new Irish pub in British Beer Company space in Hyannis. The newest kid on the block in Hyannis is the Old Triangle, an Irish pub started by Des Keogh. If that name sounds familiar, it's because Keogh has been organizing the Cape Cod St. Patrick's Day Parade for years. Settled into 412 Main Street in downtown Hyannis, the former site of British Beer Company, the Old Triangle is named for the heavy Old Triangle beaten to waken prisoners in Mountjoy Jail in Dublin. Visit theoldtriangle.com to learn more. Check out the music calendar and hear Tommy Fleming sing The Old Triangle. Looking for something easily held for takeout? Try the New England-style pasty, which includes a New England Thanksgiving dinner baked inside an Irish pasty dough. Irish for the night at Bucatino Restaurant and Wine Bar in North Falmouth. Someone get the staff at Bucatino Restaurant and Wine Bar in North Falmouth some of those buttons that say, "Everyone's Irish on St. Patrick's Day." The traditionally Italian restaurant is hosting a St. Patrick's Day celebration from 3 to 6 p.m. on March 17th. Chef Dan Delancey's menu includes corned beef and cabbage, Guinness stew, beer-battered fried fish, and, this sounds interesting, Reuben fritters. Are we talking corned beef and Swiss in deep-fried fritter dough? County Cork meets Cape Cod. Enjoy a bit of jazz during Jazztastic at Kituate Center for the Arts, by Frankie Rowley of the Cape Cod Times. In celebration of Black History and Women's History Month, Amplify POC Cape Cod and the Kituate Center for the Arts are hosting Jazztastic, two jazz shows from Tish Adams and Candida Rose and the Kabu Jazz Ensemble on March 16th and 17th. Jazz, it's sort of the most cooperative thing that I can think of, Adams said. It doesn't matter where you came from, what color you are, or how much money you have, or anything. If you're a jazz person, you fit in, and I love that. Initially, the shows were set to be part of Black History Month celebration, as this year's theme was African Americans and the Arts, according to the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. However, when working with the Kituate Center for the Arts to pinpoint dates for the shows, the team landed on March, which happens to be Women's History Month. With the theme of Women's History Month selected by the National Women's History Alliance being Women Who Advocate for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, Jean Morrison, a member of Amplify POC's board, thought the shows would work perfectly as a celebration of both events and as a larger celebration of American history. Although this concert is celebrating all African American history and women's history, it's really a history that belongs to all of us, Morrison said. That's what we're trying to do, to inspire inclusion. Adams will be on stage at 7 p.m. March 16th, and Rose will perform at 2 p.m. on March 17th. Tickets for each performance range from $13 to $53, depending on seat selection. For more information, go to the website of artsonthecape.org. And that's all I have time for today. This is your reader, Libby, saying thank you for listening.